You see, Jesus said to Thomas, in the upper chamber in the home of the legend Mary Mark, when Thomas knelt before him, and he said, "I believe." Jesus said, "Thomas, of course you believe, because you have seen, you have perceived." But he said, "Blessed are those in the ages to come who believe, though they see not." This is the making of what they call an egg and donder. This world is completely lacking in the visible evidence of a superhuman government, which is characteristic of a normal world. I once wrote a little vignette, just for kicks, of what it would be like to live a morning on a normal world. And my story opened with the delivery of the mail in this city. And the letter was addressed to a young man. And it was announcement that he'd won an Eden scholarship. Kind of like a Rhodes scholarship. Very great honor. And after he read it, showed it to his mother, he decided to take the monorail across town and visit his great-grandfather, who was hale and hearty at age 170. Because his great-grandfather had been an Eden scholar. And he called on the old gentleman and showed him his appointment. A whole 5-year scholarship at the Eudemic University. And he asked the old gentleman, and he says, "Great-grandfather," he says, "is it true that they don't die?" And the old gentleman looked at him and he said, "Yes, son, it's true." He said, "When you go there, you will see them in the full vigor of the prime of health." He said, "I saw them there as my grandfather before me saw them there, who was also an Eden scholar." And he said, "It's very interesting, you know." He said, "In the mountains beyond Eden is an older city, a city that was very old when Eden was founded, the city of the prince." And I tried to describe them. As the story ended, the young man sitting there, his eyes bright with anticipation, and the old man's eyes bright with memory. Now listen, that's a different world than we grew up on. We have a we have a memory of Adam in Genesis.
Yeah, it matches.
I got plenty. We've got a legend of Adam, but there's no Adam. There's no prince. We have nothing to see. When Adam died, the last permanent link between the material and the supermaterial on this planet was snapped. That link had persisted since the days of the prince in the person of Van, taken over by Adam. And since the days of Adam, there has been no permanent link. Yes, for 96 years, Melchizedek of Salem maintained that link. In the days of Abraham, for 4 short years, Jesus constituted such a length.
It's only 4 years, Bill.
Mm-hmm. From the time of his public ministry. I don't think he was in direct communication with anyone.
Until his baptism?
Until his baptism. Except his adjuster. Well, near the end, it's hard to say. When he told him to send his guardian angel back to be with Tiglath, the shepherd on Mount Hermon, he was beginning to break through, but that's awfully close to the beginning. There's a twilight zone there, Wilma. Well, I'm sure at age 25, though, he didn't. And I'm sure at age 32, he did. We don't have any of that on this world. There's no Adam to go to see. There's no city of the prince. We're on our own. We've had a bestowal son, or we've never had a magisterial son. The Melchizedek of the days of Salem was the nearest thing to a magisterial son. Yes, he did what he could to prepare the way for Jesus' bestowal. He came down here because, as you'll recall, they knew that Jesus had picked this planet. And there were 12 Melchizedek receivers who took over when the prince defaulted, when Adam defaulted. Pardon me, when the prince rebelled and had him default. And they took counsel with each other, and they asked for help. And everywhere they went, all they could get was, well, the planet's in your charge. And it was necessary to get some religion going down here, because the truth of the days of Adam and Eden was pretty well gone and dead. And so one of these 12 volunteered to do something which had happened only 6 previous times in the history of the local universe. He asked for permission to invest himself with flesh and blood and to teach here on earth. And it was granted. And they built a framework for it. And he moved in. And for 96 years, he taught at Salem in Palestine. Shoot.
Bill, what do you think is the difference between the
speed
of living we have now and the constant what we might be doing in our world? We live a lot better. We are told in the United States that even there are less of envy, the fact that we come from this world of trials and tribulations where we had so much experience and all. And we are constantly taught, and particularly in the churches, that I will say in the churches, your answer book itself teaches us that the overcoming of difficulties on this planet is our spiritual growth.
Yeah.
Now, according to this group right here, we are living a life of luxury, regardless, compared to the millions of people in the world that do not have it. Good. But what would our life be like compared to what it is like now if this was not an isolated world?
I think our life would be richer, but I'm not so sure it would have higher value.
I don't believe it would either.
No.
What do you mean by higher value?
I think that growing up, if you can have faith without any props. Jesus commended Thomas for his faith, but he said there's a higher order of faith than that which Thomas exercised. Thomas believed when he saw. And Jesus said, blessed are those who in the ages to come will believe, though they see not. And that is the meaning of an agendander. You have got a kind of chill steel guts, courage. You believe without any signs. And that is a higher order of faith, isn't it?
And this group right here, has absolutely no conception, actually, of what that kind of thing is when you think of what the Christians have been wondering.
Wilma, Jesus
they
said,
time, no.
Jesus said to the 12, he said, I'm not at all worried about your loyalty when times are tough. But he said in the future, when they quit being tough, and he inferred, when you're in danger of getting fat, dumb, and happy,
yes.
Then he says your loyalty could easily To oversimplify present day attitudes, I believe in our way of life because I have not only mustard but piccalilli on my hot dog and the malted milks are extra thick.
And Bill, I think the kinds of stuff that are given more help.
I think we ask for more help.
Yeah,
sure.
But I think they can
find we never had it so good and we were never in such great danger. No, I think an uncertain world like this is a lot more exciting than a normal world. And if I had my chance to transfer from here to a normal world, I would not pick up my option. I like it here. It's tough here. They raise tough characters here. I think we'll know pain on the early mansion world.
Oh, we might break a leg or two.
I think it'll be, I refer to mental pain. I think we'll be ashamed of our backwardness. And I think that kind of suffering is on the mansion world. I think the mansion world are an up-to-date, improved version of purgatory. The Catholics have a better theology than the Protestants. The Protestants give you an absolute choice of heaven or hell. You either fry forever or you're catapulted instantly into a state of absolute grace in the presence of God. The Catholic concept of purgatory is much sounder. You are not good enough to get to heaven, but you're good enough to make it if you work off your deficiencies. And purgatory is a concept of continued evolution. You know, purgative is pyrotechnic, you know, eliminate the fire and brimstone. You don't eliminate the pain. Because I don't think we will be deprived of pain as a stimulus until we've outgrown the value of pain and shame. I think we will many times experience the acute agony of the pain of shame on the first mansion world. Mammalianism shows through. You know, we procrastinate, we equivocate, we're unfair, we want it easy, we duck a problem. We haven't been de-animalized yet. The mansion worlds, to me, are the de-animalizing spheres and are quite analogous to purgatory. Purgatory has merit because one progresses in purgatory. The whole thing they're trying to do there is to finish up our growth, something which we should have done here on Earth. And which we just don't do. Jesus did it in how many years? 32? 31? How old was he? 32? Yeah, Andrew was 33. The only one that was older. He did it in 32 years. So you see, death is not inevitable, only taxes.
Am I wrong in thinking he had a head start?
You are. He had no start at all. Except they picked for him the most moral society with the best chances for education. Education was compulsory in the Commonwealth of Israel. And they picked for him a pretty good inheritance. Half Jewish and half Gentile. All Jewish in culture. He didn't pick his place or his parents. That was done by a commission. He had no more to say about his parents than you or I. They did pick for him this community, which was situated at the transportation and communication hub of the ancient world. All the trade... Yeah, all the trade routes. The rest of it was strictly up to him. He got an experienced adjuster. So did others. I'll bet a Cookie Andrew had an experienced adjuster. And remember, adjusters do not differ in quality of divinity. Your adjuster is just as divine as the one that indwelt you. They're identical fragments of God. I'm talking about the quality of divinity.
I know yes. That you are, Bill, but
in terms of his ability to grow your soul and get you to the Father, they're all alike. I think they picked highly intelligent parents for Jesus because he was a very intelligent person. They gave him good heredity. But then he was on his own.
And as I was going to say, perhaps his parents weren't quite so intelligent as their parents.
Yeah. You mean they were more educable than educated?
Mm-hmm.
This could be.
No, and none of the stories of Mary and Joseph, I get the idea They were solid citizens.
Joseph was a good businessman. Joseph was on the way to becoming rich when he was killed accidentally. He started out with normal, superior human equipment. But I don't think any more superior than, let's say, the top 20% of the human race, or the top 10%. Take the top 10% in this country. That's pretty much your teaching group, your executive group. But there's 16 million of them. This is not uncommon. Anything you've got 16 million of is not uncommon. He did what he did on his own.
Despite my different conception of Jesus as it normally accepted it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
People obscure the valor of the human Jesus with the concept of the divine Christ. And as the papers say, it's time that the human Jesus was resurrected from the theological tomb of 19th centuries and presented again to the human race. The human Jesus is a person to admire. He's a hero. The divine Christ is above us. I can't be challenged by Christ's divinity, but I can be challenged by Jesus' humanity to go and do likewise. This is a real honest challenge. You see, people want to get away from that challenge. They want to get him so high up. Well, the Catholics have got him so high up that they got to talk to Mary, and she's got him so high up. Now you've got to talk to the saints to get to Mary, to get Jesus. They've rationalized Jesus. The Protestants are pretty well rationalizing too. Biggest thing missing in Protestant religion today is the human Jesus. Listen, stop and think of Palm Sunday. He wants to get in there and teach, which is the first century equivalent of broadcasting, because they're there from Spain in the west and in India in the east, and you talk to that group, it takes a little longer, but the message travels 1,000 miles in each direction. This is the first century equivalent of broadcasting. Talk in the temple at Pentecost. He wants to get in the city, in the Sanhedrin, which is a cross between the College of Cardinals, the Jewish Senate, and the Board of Aldermen of Jerusalem, a little of each, have decided he shan't enter the city. It's his life if he enters the city. But he wants to broadcast for 3 days. Now, he doesn't invoke his divine powers. He just sits down and uses his human brain to figure out how to crack that tough nut, and you know how he cracked it. When he entered the city, he entered in such a manner that the Sanhedrin was scared to death of him. He had the acclaim of the mob, and he used that deliberate. This guy was a master psychologist. He used that to buy immunity for 3 days. They were afraid to touch him. He broadcast for 3 days. What's more, he got the bank out of the temple and had it quiet for a change. Got the static removed from his broadcast. You analyze Palm Sunday, and this Jesus did this with nothing but human intelligence. He solved the press. I've often said if I were an AP dispatch writer, the headline I'd use is "One Man Against the City." And he used nothing but human resources. He understood people. And you can tell that's all he wanted to do, because when he got there, he didn't do anything. He sat around and watched the old gal put the copper coin in the temple collection trumpet and moved out, but he was down to the next day to teach. On the mansion world, we'll have a chance to get all of the things that we miss down here, because we are an isolated world. Have you any idea what it's like to learn a really good language, an expressive language, and how interesting it will be to use English for the last time at its highest form of expression? English is spoken by post-mortal creatures, because we're going to talk English up there. They better talk English to me if they want to communicate. Or if they talk German, I want them to talk it real slow because I'm rusty. And if they want to get at me in French, they got to write it because I don't get it by ear very well. We'll talk English up there. And I dare say, we'll have reunions. One I look forward to is we'll discover that there's a whole bunch of us on one of the satellites of Edentia. Let's say we still are eating. We're beginning to have an optional way of taking on energy, but we can still eat if we want it. And we'll arrange a wing ding. We will get together and
fine bread.
We'll arrange for a short vacation, and we'll get it to the place, and we'll decorate it, and we'll fix it up like Burke's place in Oklahoma City, you know? And then we'll do our best to disguise the food, which they have up there, into the form, texture, and taste of ham and beans and some of Oscar's sweetmeats, you know. And we'll sit around and we'll talk English. Maybe the last time we'll ever speak English. And we'll have an awful time because we'll have so many concepts that won't go in English, see. We'll be using the number four when we should say many. You know? And we'll be breaking in. It'll be a kind of a bastard English. You know, like the coup is over, defense be jumping, and has the cabbage be damaged.
Now you have that bait set up.
Well, make it, would you now? Let's do it.
That should be a ball for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next thing I'm wondering though, will it be much of a job to whip up some coffee and cigarettes?
We'll have difficulty with some of our things.
You know, Bill, I would just love to believe there in the correctional state.
Yeah.
That the groups going together.
Yeah.
But if I believe that, I'm afraid people would think I'd be smug.
Yeah.
But wouldn't that be nice?
Well, fortunately, we don't have the choice. If they have need for such a group, they'll recruit us. And if they don't, our best chance is to try to make it in 3 days.
I'm not going to count on 3 days. I'm going to wait for
the next. So while we're on that 3 days, well, what does it say in the papers about
4 days?
No, before Christ come, there was no 3 days. Even Moses had to wait. What is that?
They had special resurrection.
Yeah. Well, you had to wait till the end of the dispensation period.
That's correct.
You didn't have that option then.
That's right.
We don't have an option now, do we, David?
Well, if you earn it, you do.
Oh, I don't know. I could buy one.
No, you didn't have that. It's not earned with the coins.
We don't have no option.
Do you know that the best summary of the paper we're discussing is on 567? The whole paper is summarized in less than one page.
Incidentally, you want to make that date?
Yeah.
567.
You want to be in on this? We're going to have a reunion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you wouldn't want to be in my living room without me, would you? No, we wouldn't want to either.
Well, I bet you when we get up there, all the Agin daughters will have a reunion.
Sure.
I'm going to have some topaz and her entree. Jewel hanging on the wall through that little
fish.
Oh, we gotta have the fish.
No,
that
no. We gotta have that fish.
Berkeley, you will wear red at the reunion.
Oh, I hope so.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Mm-hmm. And none of this wearing rubies like goose eggs, which would be common up there, see?
Rubies with a three already, anyway.
Just cast your eyes down this page. I'm not gonna read it aloud. You can get in trouble reading aloud sometimes. They're due next in Wilma. I think they're great ways off.
I think this book just compensates for it's not having a sooner than a kid.
This book, I think, is designed to resurrect the teachings of Jesus. It's the real purpose of this book. And to compensate us somewhat for the lack of a magisterial fund. I think it serves a dual purpose. Yes.
I said over and over to myself, and now and others, I'm completely astounded at what some of the older teachers, the prophets in the Old Testament, knew about the workings of the universe. Since we've had Uranus, and we've had an impact on this
one.
But, in other words, if this planet had come along as a normal planet, the very teachings that we find some of them lost, but some other years in the Old Testament, were teachings that were taught by Melchizedek.
Sure.
And, I mean, he taught this sort of thing in his book.
If we had a normal planet, we wouldn't need a book like this, because this kind of teaching would be taught in the schools of comparative theology, cosmology, and philosophy, and the city of the prince, and in the city of Eden. They'd have schools there. And as you had to develop the capacity, they'd go on and teach you about the super universes, and the central universe, and Havona. They'd write textbooks about this, because Adam and Eve knew all about this when they came down here. The planetary prince knew all about it. His corporeal staff had gone through the schools of Jerusalem. And if they'll tell us this on your ranch, they're going to do a lot better by you when you get to Jerusalem. We'll know a lot more than that. I have reason to suspect, and I say suspect, that the original version of this book is a record on Jerusalem. And that I want to read. The unexpurgated Urantia book. The Urantia book, not limited by the English language. Well, don't you know that they'd probably try to keep something like that? What did the Divine Counselor really try to say about the Universal Father? He talks Uversa. You can't translate that in English. The two languages have nothing in common. You must translate Uversa into Salvington with some law. Then you translate Salvington into Satania with further law. Then you translate Satania into English with great law. And I shouldn't be surprised, but less than 0.1% of the original concept would come through that series of translations. But you see, the older inhabitants of Jerusalem have learned Satania, have learned Salvington and Uversa. And I'll bet a cookie, the original draft are of record in this local system. Because you just don't get divine counselors every day to discuss these points in a formal way. How many thousand papers do you suppose there are in the first draft of the Urantia book before it began to narrow down? How many thousands of papers do you suppose there are?
I wonder how many editors there had to be.
I wouldn't know. When you get mathematics that goes beyond three, you can talk more freely. But when you are limited to 1, 2, 3 men, you can't talk too much about numbers.
You know, had all the papers come through and the questions
that's...
All right, the paper came through.
Our recorder is on, Wilma. Mm-hmm. Our recorder is on.
Oh.
I'll talk to you later.
Turn that off, number.
Let's talk about planetary mortal ethics.
I have a very good reason to suspect that.
Mel, how did this deal they built for Michael? That's on the
Mansion World. Where is that at Jerusalem?
It's on Jerusalem. It's a temple dedicated to the unrevealed adventure. I think. Am I correct?
Yes, that's what I'm thinking about.
I think they're talking about the next universe age.
Quite
hasn't
been unveiled.
That's right.
Boy, they've been preparing ahead of time a long time.
Yes, they do.
On this earth, it's deteriorating fall down.
Well, it doesn't rain up there. They just have dew.
But it's more substantial material, too. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm thinking.
I don't know what lies ahead on this world. I think we're going to have a world which is always going to be different from the norm. I question if the races are going to blend here. I think we will work out a common language someday.
Common government?
We're going to work out some kind of common government, or sooner or later blow ourselves to kingdom come. Our choice between war and peace has gotten to be very serious. And I would suspect that our supervisors have taken the attitude, if they're going to fight, if we can't convince them any other way, let's let them realize how really serious it is. We are just now, I think, beginning to get the first of the tools of civilization, atomic energy. I think historians will someday date the Industrial Revolution from about 1945 and say that everything preceding 1945 will be kind of put in with the Stone Age. You know what I mean? And they will say the dawn of scientific material civilization was 1945 when man...
After what they call World War II.
Yes.
Which was brought about by World War II.
Right. And they will consider today as the later days of barbarism. Someday historians will date civilization at a time far future to the present time. I don't think they're going to call us civilized someday when they have a real civilization. I'm reminded that the Europeans who lived in the 12th century A.D. spoke of themselves as moderns. You know, now that's funny to us. And we call ourselves civilized, and someday that's going to sound funny to our successors.
Well, the book calls us semi-civilized.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be shocking if somebody didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Really.
Arnold Toynbee refers to us as man in process of civilization. I think it's accurate and kind. We're in process, but we sure ain't there.
Our growth and all the adjectives
they used to describe in last week's lesson. I think our...
Pardon me?
No.
There is a tremendous comparison, which we would have projected, between 12 A.D. and now.
Projected, George.
Good Lord. What do you mean projected? I could no more think of a comparison between what's now and what was then, and 1900 and some years from now? With what has happened in the last 15 years?
I think our civilization has taken a turn. Let me paint a parallel picture to you. The Mediterranean world grew up as a Hellenistic, Greco-Roman culture. The heart of it was in Italy and Greece, and the soul of this civilization was in the little city-states that speckled that whole area. Tarentum, Capua, Rome, Syracuse in the west, Athens, Argolis, Thebes, Corinth, Sparta, Olynthus, Elis, Megaris, Pylos in Greece. These city-states contended, and now I'm going to oversimplify this story. I'm going to leave out some things in the East because we haven't got forever. They contended among themselves and strutted their stuff and engendered philosophy and writing and poetry and drama. Just think, there was a day when a man invented prose. At least as far as we can tell, he invented prose, because all previous writing has been poetic. Prose was a great discovery. And this went on and on until one day this little group of city-states discovered it was surrounded by comparatively large kingdoms. Rome had become a territorial state. Syracuse had become a territorial state. Carthage, non-Hellenic, had become a territorial state. Macedonia, Egypt, Syria were all states of new magnitude. And little by little, these larger states dwarfed the city-states of Greece. And one by one, they slugged it out for supremacy. Pindus ended Macedon. Magnesia ended Syria. And Cleopatra pretty well finished off Egypt. Hannibal was Carthage's last gasp. And Rome, at the end of the battle royal, emerged as the victor. Rome consolidated her power and went through periods of decay and comeback, and decay and comeback. And again, if we ignore the East and keep this story simple, she was finally overrun. The barbarians broke through the lines. In the early 5th century, the last real Caesar was a guy by the name of Majorum, who was an effective commander of Roman troops, but the German field marshal, or magister militum, or political boss, pulled a rug out from under him, and there was no effective Caesar in the West after that. And pretty soon the Western kingdoms, the barbarian states, had taken over all of Roman territory. And if we ignore a little recrudescence of East Roman power in the 6th century, you know, Justinian, Belisarius, Italy, and North Africa, we can see a decay of civilization until we have the rise of a new milieu of city-states in Europe.
In the recording.
In the West, civilization is born again in another galaxy of city-states, very much like the old Greek one. When you think of Florence in the days of the Medici, where everyone is very sophisticated, and you make sure that your host glass is filled with the same bottle that yours was filled out of, and you make sure he drinks first. Today we still test the wine, and that actually is not to tell the bouquet, it's to assure your guest it's not poisoned. Wilderette makes a good point. In this highly sophisticated Florence of the Medici, he says the civilization is hard to describe, but Alcibiades of Athens would have felt at home. And Alcibiades was a kind of a double dealer who was so brilliant that you just couldn't afford to live without him. This group of city-states ran all up Central Europe. The free cities of the Holy Roman Empire, the Hansa cities of the Baltic, the patchwork of city-states in Italy. And you have a reproduction of the same type of cultural configuration which characterized the Greek and Italian peninsulas in the ancient world. And little by little you have the rise around these city-states of larger territorial states. And one above the others is better organized. That's France. And remember, in these days there were 25 million Frenchmen and only about 6 million Englishmen. France was the largest, most prosperous, best organized of the city-states. And you have the beginning of a reproduction of ancient history.
Within about 700 years.
Yeah. And what happens? You have France well organized under Richelieu, Mazarin, and then you have Louis XIV. And it took all Europe to hold France down as he threw his armies. And it took the genius of Marlborough. You have a decay of a generation in France. And then you have the breakthrough of a new idea. Liberty, equality, fraternity. And you have a totally new principle of war introduced. You have put new wine in old wineskins. You have infused nationalism with patriotism. The American Revolution was the first patriotic war. It wasn't very large. But the Napoleonic Wars were the first real patriotic wars, where a whole nation stood to heart. And this time, they barely contained him. And the only reason Napoleon didn't knock Europe out was because Europe had outgrown an area. And there was non-European Russia to the east, and there was England, with the Industrial Revolution and the ability to draw raw materials from the New World. And this is what kept Napoleon from making it as Rome made it. And the next bid was in 1914. And this time America tipped the scales and it became impossible to achieve a decision in the old cultural area of Europe. It is as though the Han Empire had been able to intervene geographically in the days of Rome. and cast decisive weight against the Romans. The European Empire should have been established by Napoleon, and would have been established had not Russia been too vast and England been able to mobilize the resources of North America. Kaiser Bill should have established the European Empire. Again, outside of Europe came the power to redress this. Hitler made the last bid. And until Napoleon, you can trace a parallel between ancient history and modern history. But since Napoleon, you don't have a parallel. The European Empire is overdue, has been overdue, for 200 years. And the reason it doesn't get established is because power outside of immediate Europe is able to stop the strongest power in Europe from doing it. England stopped Napoleon. The United States has twice stopped Germany. Each time Russia was involved, all three times Russia was involved. Now, the last chance to establish a world empire vanished sometime in the early 1950s. This country could have done it at any time after World War I because for 6 years, I think, or 4 years, we had the sole stock of atomic weapons. And we didn't do it.
World War II.
World War II. Now, we've got a two-way deal of America versus Russia with two other nations that have technically joined the atomic club, and others will follow. England and France are the only other two.
Red China has one, I don't think.
Not to public knowledge.
I don't bet they've exploded one yet.
They don't claim
France
one.
And, well, I think Jerusalem
has sent up a rocket.
Well,
Israel sent up
Israel's
a rocket.
One.
But it wasn't atomic. It wasn't an atomic bomb.
I thought it was.
It was a. It was a high altitude rocket, I think.
Well, China's working.
I thought Red China had
they're trying to get it, but they haven't.
We have a choice now between peace or genocide.
Yeah.
It's not war anymore, it's genocide. But to me, there's a very interesting parallel between the history of Europe and the history of the ancient Mediterranean up to a point. And you could pretty well see why it deviates. It took a coalition of powers to stop Louis XIV. And even a coalition could not stop Napoleon. It took extra European power to stop Napoleon. And to stop Germany in 1914. And again in 1939.
Well,
let me give you a little hope. I can see a pattern of hope evolving. In the early American West, there was something about some kind of a law west of the Pecos. It's whatever kind of artillery you could pack with.
No, that was Judge Bean.
I see. Well,
of course, that depended on artillery, I'll grant you. He laid it on the table.
We had turbulence out there. All kinds of scalawags and rascals, as well as honest adventurous folk, flocked to the West. And I dare say in many communities, they had things pretty much their own way. They chewed up the town, they pushed this one around and that one around, till finally there would get to be enough businessmen guys who wanted a little peace because it was interfering with business. And they formed a vigilante committee. And this is embryonic law and order. And after the vigilantes committee, sooner or later there comes the sheriff and established law and order. As I read modern history, the first vigilantes action took place in the Boxer Rebellion at the turn of the century. This was where China, the nationalistic rebellion against the westernization of China, and my hearts are with those Boxers, because Lord knows the Westerners had really pushed the Chinese around. We'd insisted that they smoke opium because it was profitable to sell it to them. When the Chinese government tried to prohibit opium, the British and French fought them. And with superior armament, whipped the dickens out of them, and you import opium. You can't blame Chinese resentment of the West. How would you like it if the Chinese had twice whipped the United States to ensure the importation of morphine, cocaine, and heroin in this country? It's an analog. I read an item written by a commander and educated civil servant about 1830. He analyzed the problem. He said, our problem is that we do not understand this technology. And it's not enough that we buy these instruments of warfare. We must learn how to make them. This is an intelligent man analyzing China's military weakness. Well, at any rate, the Boxers besieged the legations. This is a breach of international law. And so an international army was formed. I guess the first of its kind. There were Americans, English, Russians, Germans, French, Italians, and Japanese. And they moved in from Tenzin to Peking. And I guess the early contingents made their fortune in the looting of the Summer Palace in Peking. It was full of priceless art treasures. The Johnny-come-latelys only got moderately rich. Now that was the action of a vigilantes committee. This was not a nation or a couple of allies pushing someone around. This was the whole of the Western world, including Japan, which had got up to Western technology. The first legal war that was ever fought in the history of this world was the Korean War. And whatever was right or wrong about the Korean War, it was a legal war. It was declared in accordance with law. Thank God the Russians weren't in the Security Council. Now that is a moral advance, regardless of whether you like what happened in Korea or not. I'm not too happy about what happened. But it was a legal war. It was fought by an American army, thinly disguised as the United Nations Command. But legally, it was the United Nations Command. And that is the first sheriff's action that's ever been taken on the face of this world. The second sheriff's action that was taken was when international troops went into the Gaza Strip to quiet down the intense friction between the Israelis and the Egyptians. And that was a legal action taken in the name of a supranational government. Whatever happens in the Congo, or does not happen in the Congo, this is the third legal action in the use of force in the history of this world.
Well, it doesn't look like you
men's
gone, but went down there,
does it? Wilma, the early sheriffs usually got killed by the gunmen. The earliest sheriff didn't look too good for law and order, unless you hired the best gunman and put a star on him. You follow me? It It wasn't until 1932 or 31 that the nations of this world said that war is bad. The Kellogg-Briand Pact was the first time in planetary history that the governments of this world even said war is bad. These, to me, are significant moral steps forward, and I refuse to be discouraged because this particular sheriff happens to be taking a cut from this gambling house. You follow me? All the early sheriffs were not good, but they were improvements on the vigilantes committees, and the vigilantes committees were improvements on lawlessness. I see the slow evolution of moral international law and order. These, to me, are rays of hope. And I'm not concerned about the foolishness of any individual on any one job. And I'm not even sure that this evolution will be successful. But it's the one hopeful thing I see in modern times.
Bill, I may be entirely wrong in Texas, but I'll tell you, it seems to me that the morals of the American people are at their lowest scale.
Well, that's been true before, too. You know, Victorian England was supposed to be very religious, even prudish. But there was more prostitution in Victorian London than there is today. Open prostitution.
Well, that's hard to believe. Of course, I haven't been over there for 2 years.
Commercially kept women were socially acceptable in certain circles, cafe societies, please, in Victorian England. I tell you what you do, Wilma, get a pretty well-written book entitled The Girl with the Swan Down Seat. It's a kind of a catchy title. It's a story of prostitution in Victorian England. It's rather well-written, it's not pornographic. It's good sociology. It's good sociology. We overlook. Here, we glorify our past. Therefore, we're dismayed at the present. A careful analysis, for example, of the Old Testament suggests that times have gotten better since then, not worse.
Well, I am more concerned about the low morals of our government, our high office,
that
I am
prostitution. Well, they're all signs of the time. Prostitution, street solicitation is illegal in London now. And I guess it is in Paris, too.
I wouldn't know.
Have you been to Paris lately?
Not lately.
Well, they were thinking of passing last week.
No, I see some hope. And I'm not too concerned about the corruption of the sheriff. We got a sheriff. We didn't even used to have a sheriff. Wilma, it's like a chap that was rather cynically commenting. He said, "What chance does a poor man have in court?" Well, I said, "That's quite a compliment you pay our court system." Well, he says, "I don't mean to." I said, "Listen, friend, 1,000 years ago, poor man wasn't even supposed to have nerve enough to show up in court. Now at least we say we have equal justice. This is a moral advance." Wilma, I have a different perspective on modern times because I have studied olden times more carefully, and I think we're better off today than we have been at many times in the past. I don't think much of King David's morals. I think he treated Colonel Uriah shamefully. You know what I mean?
He definitely did.
Right. And I don't think much of the morals of the Davidic court. because it says in the Bible, when David was old and his body gat no heat, they did put a virgin in bed with the king. And when he did not react, they knew the end was near. Unquote. Now, I don't think much of that kind of a
society. You say, when you stop and think about actually, in comparison to the length of time, that the virgin had to be in the process, there are very few years actually between
sure.
the time you were testing
them now. Now, I'm sure if Kennedy were dying, they would not use that technique either to warm the president. We just don't do things like that anymore.
Well, it might recuperate him, but he's going on him.
I know.
You all in the last brief digest of the about the clergyman on the street corner. He was with his back and he had a quite a collection of people around him. And a very beautiful, well-built female went by and he stopped. Watchers of the turn the corner. They turned back to the crowd and said, I am never ceased to be amazed at the handiwork of women.
Bill, what may have happened, or what could have been the outcome had the Carthaginian quit Rome?
They darn near did. If the Carthaginians had given Hannibal any support, they would have quit Rome. But they left him stranded over there with the exception of one reinforcing army, which came from Spain, not from Carthage.
That was his brother.
Hasdrubal. It was at the, I think the Battle of the Metaurus, wasn't it, when they whipped him. I think it would have been a tragedy in the Western Mediterranean, because this civilization was commercial and pretty venal. It was built around the dollar. Even Hannibal had trouble in Carthage afterwards and had to get out. Carthage produced some amazing characters, particularly in the family of Hannibal. But I think a Carthaginian victory would have been a very tragic thing for the history of Western civilization.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah. The Romans had two tactics which proved to be invincible, and they were both ideas. They had the Senate. So you couldn't make peace with the commander. The Senate wasn't honored. And secondly, they fellowshipped the people they took in. They either made Romans out of them, or they made Latin allies. And people enjoyed that federation. The Romans effectively used the federal principle. The Greeks discovered it. The best example of it was up in the, you know, that finger-like peninsula in the base of Greece, sticks out in the Aegean. There was a group of four cities up there in the late 4th century that discovered the federal principle, but the Spartans stopped them. And a generation later, the Macedonians annexed them. And when dual citizenship was invented in Greece, it was too late. The Romans were too strong. No, I take some comfort, Wilma, from the small advances we make, because I have a fair knowledge of how terrible it's been all along. We glamorize the past. We think about Merry England, and Merry England was a pretty hungry country much of the time. We identify ourselves with the rich and the powerful of ancient times. But most people were neither rich nor powerful.
Well, fortunately, that's been a good one. He would be concerned about it. It actually did nothing. But I could do except that one little small vote for next time.
Yeah.
cast my vote for our present governor last election. I still think it's crazy to see what the cooks out there, what they've done for us. You're not familiar with it, but we're back in the room of somebody with what they've done for us.
Our whole hope for success is the revival of the Whig Party. I'm the last living Whig, George.
You are?
Mm-hmm.
Let's start a Whig Party. Wilma? Actually, it will make no difference whether you voted for this governor or you vote for whoever the next governor is, or whether you voted for the governor for this, the vote for the governor is going to do no good. The boys you referred to are still there.
Oh,
it takes more than just the governor.
Well, it takes more than the governor. You are so right, and I don't think you're going to do my consideration. But you know what? For senators and representatives, here in our state, we have a
fourth member. Well, move on to another state, and you'll find the same thing in effect. No. No. No.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how we can get this bunch of crooks out of
politics. Very little.
I just don't know how we can.
That's plenty. Thank you.
Get some honest people to run for office.
That's the thing.
You
now, the morals are not low. The morals of the people there may be low, but the morals in general can be high.
Well,
yeah.
I think that's what we're going to have to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to
get
our people involved.
But we do not, as a public, interest ourselves enough in our own government. We sit back and let the boys to wish to run. This is the big thing.
And our decisions affecting us as citizens, decisions are made not on the floor of the House of Lords, but at some cocktail party.
Well,
I don't think it's possible.
No, but we're she's talking about politically and economically.
Is it the decision made at the cocktail party you are disagreeing with? The place where it was made, or the fact that it was not made on the floor itself?
Not made on the floor itself. The men were pyramided and not in the
Well, when we get men from all over the various counties of the state, man, maybe.
We're all from Oklahoma.
Run for an office. That will be the difference. They may not be experienced politicians, but they'll apply themselves to the job that they're to do while they're there.
A lot of people
would
probably run if they
clean up the...
If they could win.
No. So you clean
up after
we got
in?
But you can't.
But yeah,
no,
there's no reason why you can't. The old clique's in there in the
Senate. To get them out. That's what you're talking about.
If they have such a reputation, no one wants to show them in that territory. In other words, if they run for, they better get sorry. I think that should be done.
So now you're saying it has gotten to be so grayishly black,
mm-hmm,
that there is no sense in trying to make it white. So to
no,
hell with it.
No, I don't
this is what this
I,
is the reaction of all the people that surround the state.
I
get into this many times. Because I've been in
it. You know how far it'll go as far as public sentiment will let it go, and then it'll change. That's how far it'll go. It'll get so rotten.
Oh, it has gotten that
rotten.
The
public sentiment will
get, turn this off,
tired of it, and then it'll change.
I
All right, that's
that deal's over.
No.
We're
just
wasting
magical time.
I'm sorry, I got off on that.
This
happens
always to many counties. Have you ever heard that we feel that we went too far in this country and we set it up? And we've gone even farther since then. Did you know that to the founding fathers in this country, the word democracy had almost the connotation that communism has today?
Mm-hmm.
Democracy was a dirty word to Washington, Adams, and the like. They wanted no part of a democracy. They wanted a republic, a representative government. You ought to read de Tocqueville's description of the United States in the 1830s, when the Republic was dying and democracy was born, when every cheap politician was offering more franchise to get elected. This is where we embraced democracy. And this was an un-American ideal to the fathers of our country. Democracy was a French degraded importation to this country. This sounds pretty bad, but this is borne out in the writings of the founding fathers. I think this country went too far away from differential rewards. It's been said that the voice of the people is the voice of God, and certain questions have been raised about how complementary this is to God. The voice of the people is oftentimes the voice of the mob. If you read government on a neighboring planet, you'll find it's not a democracy. Everyone does not have the same vote. Everyone has one vote, but they have plural franchise. On Jerusalem, they are evolving toward a representative government. And you have a franchise extending from one vote to 1,000 votes, depending on your status. They test you out, and they give you your franchise. This country, may I suggest, when it abolished hereditary honors, made the mistake of not keeping earned honors. It gave man only money to work for in the long run. I think those members of the House of Lords in England who are life peers have a lot to carry considerable moral weight, because they got there because of their achievements in common. They were not born there. Now, if this country had earned honors, I'm going back to Paris and fashions now, you give people something to work for. Napoleon understood this psychology. He couldn't afford to make men dukes and endow them appropriately. So he gave them something which usually you couldn't buy with money. He gave them a little ribbon to wear in their lapel. It's called the French Legion of Honor. And men worked very hard for that ribbon. Let's say that we had honors in this country. And to avoid bad semantics, we won't have dukes and earls and marquises. We'll pick a Roman title. We pick senators, so we'll have tribunes. A tribune is a very coveted position. You have subtribunes, if you want to, and tribune aspirants. We have three grades, see? This award is given by court action by congressional resolution or by presidential appointment.
Yeah, it can be bought. You give enough money to the party, you could buy one of these. But mostly it's earned.
I'm allowing for some corruption here because there's going to be some corruption in any human institution. But a lot of guys get this because when they've made a pile, then they go into politics. And they don't have to worry about not being elected. They're going to eat. I mean, they've got it made. And what's more, they bring to politics all of the sharp wits which they got in making this pile. And why do they go into politics? It's boudoir pressure. I want you to visualize America 50 years from now. The title Tribune is an honored and coveted title. And Mr. and Mrs. Moneybags are getting ready to go to a dance in a country club. And Mrs. Moneybags is sitting in front of the, doing what Mrs. Moneybags does, you know. And she says, George.
Yeah.
Why can't you do something besides just make money? Now she says, you know, Mrs. Jones, the country club, she's invited to join the Anastasia Society. And it's limited to those who are related to tribunes within one degree of relationship. Why don't you go into politics, George? Now, this gal has got him where he lives. She sleeps with him. She's at breakfast, at cocktails, at dinner, at the dance. George, why don't you go into politics? And one of these days, George will go into politics to make peace in the family. And being a competitive soul, and being effectively competitive, is quite apt to earn the title of tribune, which does not descend to his son. This, I think, is how we could lure the brains of America out of business and into politics. Into teaching, too, if you please. Into the ministry, if you please. This country, in my humble opinion, has suffered an internal hemorrhage. All its brains are in the internal organs of business. And we've got political, educational, and church anemia.
Mm-hmm.
We get just as many smart people as we ever had, but they don't enter these pursuits.
Well, here, about the time of the Civil War, the smart men, you take in the old times, like the Revolutionary Jefferson, Monroe, and Adams, we had brilliant men in government then, but men found they could have more power for money than they would in the industry. And that's where our brain is in the industry. It's not in politics.
I thought of teaching. And I know exactly when I had my chance. I wrote a thesis on, was inspired out of the blue book, the reasons for the failure of evolution in Greece. Taking the evolution of religion in, among the Jews as an example of success. And I got offered a fellowship in the Oriental Institute. And I thought for a month before I turned it down. But I wasn't sure I could make enough money in teaching to educate my children. And I wanted some kids. And I just didn't have a big enough ego to think I could make that kind of money teaching. And I felt pretty sure I could make it in the field of commerce. So I picked commerce.
You know, there again, there's too much concern about education.
Sure.
I know the other man thinks that they get about $8,000 for the college now. You're lucky still.
I'd like, that guy to talk to my kids. I think he's living in a daydream, but go ahead. I suppose you could do it for 8.
In the
church. I figured they're at 12.
How many years are they going to go, Wilma? 4 or 7? 4. Well, if they're going to 7, they usually have to work part of
the time.
But, oh, that's so good for them. It's so much better for them than it is the way most of them are going through college now. The brains for the car, come home every evening. Have to make the best sorority for their fraternity.
Well, you know, Clyde's oldest boy is... They can't work now and go to med school.
This is not possible.
They used to be. They can't do it. He goes to school every morning. He studies till midnight every night.
You go to med school.
Hey, what?
The new method is that you marry and your wife works. That's the risk, too.
He studies till midnight, practically every night.
There's another thing that...
They used to be able to work their way through.
There was another thing I feared about teaching, and that is the drift from reality. To be a young teacher would be a joy. But as you stand in front of that blackboard all those years, and you never prove it, how do you know you're real, what you're teaching? Yeah. And you get farther and farther away from your students, and they have less and less chance of calling the shots on you. How do you know what you're teaching is real?
Well, that is some error in our school,
yeah.
Another way is that we're not paying high enough dollars to draw the best brains.
Another one is they've made a union out of it. One of the great merchants, Wilma. Oh, this guy's a doll. He's got a beautiful mind. He's so level-headed and sensible. He earned his way to the very top of the merchandising heap in the J.L. Hudson Company. And the last year they were under one roof, they beat Macy's for the highest volume single unit in the United States. Lou has got a nice, comfortable IQ of about 145. Just a pleasant guy to talk to. Lou wanted to teach merchandising at Ann Arbor, University of Michigan. He thought he'd be fun to teach for 5 years after he retired. Do you know something? They wouldn't accept him.
Why, Bill?
He had only a bachelor's degree. Those fools. What a course in retail merchandising Lou Sappington could have taught. This to me, I'm horrified at that attitude, but you see, this would displace a teacher. Now, at the University of Bologna, in the early Middle Ages, they worked out such a tight union that if your father wasn't a teacher, you couldn't get on the faculty. This is the tendency of every professional group to make a union out of it. Do you know that the average professor in the average university could not teach at the high school level? He wouldn't have enough credit in the field of education. He only knows his subject, and he's only been teaching, but he hasn't got enough educational credit. This is one of the most shameful unions in the United States. Alongside of this, Walter Reuther doesn't bother me. Walter Reuther isn't messing with the kids. This union is messing with the kids. And that is the school that turns out 3/4 of the teachers for the Chicago school system. If you graduate from that school, you're in. You have all the proper political connections.
Hmm?
daughter?
Yeah, she got married in March. She should be back at the tail end of it.
And they're going to live in Europe?
No, they're going to live over here. Probably on me. Temporarily. I strongly suspect this.
Well, did she marry an American boy?
No, she married a German boy.
German?
Mm-hmm.
What's her basic?
About a year away from his PhD in language.
She'll try to finish here?
Yes, but I don't think he'll be able to get in anywhere for a year. They're coming over too late. If he needs a job, I'm going to hire him to translate aptitude tests into foreign languages. That's going to be his official status on the payroll. But actually, I'm going to sit him down to translate the Urantia book into German.
I remember you were working on that.
I think Pat will be with me on it. Oh, very much so. Yeah, she when she kissed me goodbye in New York, she says, "Daddy, if I marry Freddie, I'll count him as a translator in the book." Well, if he needs a job, we got him in a vice this evening.
Have you ever talked about the, what would you say, adequacy? The translation into another language. Although they still say 1, 2, 3, many.
It's in French, you know.
Yeah, and I've been told. How hard is it to carry the same in translation? Is everything the same?
No. But you can get the true equivalent. For example, the expression. We have an English expression. He has slippery fingers. In German, you say he has long fingers. And you said exactly the same thing. If you have a comparable idiom, or you may find a word you cannot translate. In German, there's the word Gestalt. There is no such word in English. It's now in Webster's dictionary, taken right over from the German. There's no English word for gemütlich in German. You can describe it. Sorry, do you have a little German?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then you know what I mean. I'm not so sure that there's a good English translation for the Spanish simpático. No word comes to mind. But you can translate master son.
You can feel
maître fils. That's it in French. I saw it.
You can feel simpático.
Yeah. And feel gemütlich too. You can experience gemütlich kind.
Feel free.
Oh, flee. I gotta come back probably next month sometime. I don't know when. Take care. And let's pray for the government.
It's been so good, and thank you for the nice dinner. Thank you for coming over. Good night.
I
thank you.
Love you.
I just have to go. I worked so hard this last week that I'm just so weary. I just need rest so bad. I'm going to go.
I worked for me.
I understand.
She's a big person, too.
But she sent me a nice
job.
I'm very
happy.
Well,
good night.
I will.
Maybe you had a
shake
hand and use that flower tonight. Can I shake hands with you?
Do this.
I Well, yeah, I just want to keep your job. Now, I got Helen over here. I'm out. I see y'all
Wednesday.
We'll be
here. Wilma, we never did turn the machine off and have you ask that question again.
I don't think Bill wants
it. Turned off, Bert.
Don't keep me a minute now.
Well, what was the question?
I said, is the question.
12-2-62.
You know, I got an idea. Before you all hit me with 1900 questions, I'd like to talk a little bit about a kind of thinking which I think would be profitable for this group at its present stage of intellectual evolution in relation to the world. It's a kind of thinking which I think we can periodically refresh ourselves with. We are actually attempting something that is impossible. We are trying to work conceptually on three levels of reality: finite, absolute, and essence. And we're getting all confused.